Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're going to be discussing multiple sclerosis, the disease and its treatment, some local resources, and the answers to your questions on Line 1 today. Our guests are Mo Hillstrand. She's an advanced nurse practitioner, has a doctorate in nursing practice, and specializes in neurologic diseases and a large portion of her practice is multiple sclerosis, so she's got a lot of experience. Antonia Fowler is the director of the Alaska Multiple Sclerosis Center here in Anchorage and a licensed physical therapist. Jessica Henning is our third guest. She's the program co-coordinator of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, the Greater Northwest Chapter. If you've got questions or comments or would just like to give us your experiences with multiple sclerosis, you're welcome to do so during the next hour. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. If you go to that address, you can listen to the program again at any time. And also you can go to iTunes into the podcasts and put in iTunes in the search engine and you can come up and listen that way as well to any of our past broadcasts. Let me say hi to the three of you and welcome for coming to Line 1.
Thank you. Hi.
Mo, let's start with some idea about multiple sclerosis, what it is, a little bit of what we call the epidemiology of it, so we got some idea of what we're talking about.
Sure, thanks, Ed. So when a person develops MS, we think that it's an autoimmune disorder. A person has to have the genetic predisposition for this disorder to occur. And what we think happens is a person is probably exposed to a virus, and somehow the immune system is learns that a certain type of protein is bad. And so the white blood cells, being our army, tries to go out and destroy anything that invades us that shouldn't be there. And so commonly the disease manifests between the ages of 20 and 40. And so a person may start to have tingling or numbness, weakness in an extremity or a body part. And it gets worse and then gets better, and by the time they see their primary provider, it's gone. So quite often people will have symptoms that they just sort of blow off. Mm-hmm. And eventually, I think the most common thing that people come to their provider for is optic neuritis, which is a common presenting symptom of MS, where they get pain and blindness in one eye. And that brings a lot of people in to see their provider. The disease itself is a central nervous system disorder, and so what happens is the white blood cells get in across the blood-brain barrier, which they're not supposed to do, and the white blood cells chew on the myelin, which we'll talk a little bit about the physiology of the brain. The myelin is the covering, or, you know, like in a house, you have electrical wiring, and it has covering around it, and so in our brain, many of the cells in the white manner have that covering or myelin surrounding those nerves so that they transmit the electrical impulses without shorting out. And so the white blood cells will chew on that myelin, and we don't know exactly how much chewing a white blood cell has to do before the cell can't survive. So people will lose central nervous system cells, which is no good. We need all our brain cells that we have. And so as the disease progresses over time, different people will have a different course. You can't compare one person with MS to another because we don't know where those lesions will land, lesions or spots, plaques, they call them all kinds of things. But the fact remains is that there's damage to the central nervous system. So first off, a person needs to be genetically predisposed to that. And the researchers are looking at different places on the genome where they have found these loci that contribute to MS. To the best of my understanding, there's about 50 plus areas on the genome that we know are involved in either upregulating or downregulating the immune system in order for a person to develop this disorder. And then over time, they have to be exposed to that virus. And of course, there's a whole cadre of researchers looking to try and figure out what that particular virus is. And then as with most autoimmune disorders, they don't manifest until about the ages of 20 to 40. Mm-hmm. It's more common in women than in men.
Which is true of a lot of autoimmune
problems. Of all of them, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think they're five times more common in women than in men. Mm-hmm. And With MS, in the general U.S., it's about 3 women to 1 male for MS. In the Scandinavian countries, it's a little bit higher, and I think that our statistics here in Alaska are similar to those in Helsinki, for example, because Anchorage and Helsinki are the same latitude, and we find MS greater proportions, and I think it's 50 to 70 degrees north or south of the equator. So there's that band.
Mm-hmm. So autoimmune disease means a disorder where our immune system gets turned on to attack normal tissues. And it's not an unusual thing. We know that lupus, even in a sense you could argue rheumatoid arthritis, even rheumatic fever where strep infections begin to attack our body attacks a white, our heart valves and parts of our brain, which is another autoimmune kind of thing. So these are not unusual. We say that this is the most likely situation because we can reproduce these kind of things in animals, but ethically they're hard to do in humans, so we have to do the best we can. So it doesn't mean we don't know. It's just we're being very, very cautious about saying it. But that seems to be the likely reason for all of these autoimmune diseases, some infectious trigger that does this.
And the immune system is so complex. You know, we don't think much about our immune system, but it's like if you equated it to the national security or something, it'd be our Air Force, our Army, and, you know, all branches of the military. So the immune system itself is quite complex, and we don't understand all of the components of that. It's kind of like one thing will trigger a portion of the immune system cascade, and then you don't know exactly where that's going to play out. So we don't know all of the ramifications of a trigger to the immune system.
So in this particular disorder, for reasons that are not clear, some genetic predisposition, our immune system gets triggered. If you have the right genetic inheritance, your immune system may then begin to attack myelin in the central nervous system. Where, when, to what degree, whether it repairs or not, are things that make this a very difficult disorder to say what's going to happen. It has lots of different manifestations
and
variability.
And human beings are not rocks. You know, we have other disorders going along as well, plus aging. So, you know, all of those phenomena play in. I mean, we don't respond the same to any disorder when we're 20 as we do when we're 60. And MS is a lifelong disorder to the best of our understanding. So
it's fair to say right now we don't know how to turn off this immune response to cure. So cures are, like so often we'd like to see, are still elusive in medicine to a large degree.
That's
particularly
correct.
In these disorders.
We can, since 1993, we have medications, though, that we can treat MS. And so in 1993 they came out with the first of a class of medications to treat MS, the interferons. And so, as the name implies, they interfere with the immune system cascade so that these medications downregulate that immune response and keep those cells from crossing the blood-brain barrier and chewing on the myelin. That's the goal. So there's 3 medicines in that class, and then they came out with another medication, a different class. It's the Gladimer acetate, and it works in the periphery and actually acts kind of like a decoy where it lures the cells away from... It's kind of interesting.
Does our peripheral nervous system have a myelin covering, or is it only the central nervous system? Okay. It's not clear that, I think, but this is primarily a central nervous system disorder.
Right. And all, well, if you think about the brain, there's the white matter, you know, the big major tracks that go from the gray matter. The gray matter is gray because it's not covered with myelin mostly, and then the white matter is white because it is covered with myelin. And then those tracks run down the spinal cord. So that's all central nervous system.
From talking to some researchers recently about myelin in particular, we know that myelin does help the conduction. So the better it's myelinated, and the more we use a particular nerve track or something, the better it gets myelinated, the faster, the more accurate the transmission of information. So somebody that's playing a violin all the time has, you can actually see the differences. So this is a very complex issue, so that there may be in a sense, there's just little hits going to that myelin at times. Again, just trying to describe how these symptoms can kind of wax mm-hmm. and wane, come and go, be kind of, well, I don't know if that's important or not kind of stuff. What I heard you say, and which I think is important, is one of the most common symptoms is this optic neuritis. Mm-hmm. So let's just focus on that for a second.
Sure.
What do people notice if they have that?
Physiologically, what happens is they'll have, in the optic tract behind the eye, they'll have an area where the myelin is being destroyed. Mm-hmm. And so it's unclear how much damage is done before a person actually experiences the change in vision. And patients will commonly describe to me that they have a sense of veiling, like there's a curtain in front of their vision, not necessarily complete washout of color, though there's clearly a change in the way they see. It's rarely, if ever, in both eyes at the same time, though the same person can sometimes get optic neuritis in one eye and later have it in the other one. More often than not, it will be just one eye, and they'll get veiling sometimes to the point of complete blindness. Mm-hmm. And it can be quite painful as well. So that usually a patient will call their eye doctor, and they'll get in and see their eye doctor, and then that's when they get sent to me.
So once you see someone who's familiar and capable of looking at the back of the eye and seeing where the optic nerve mm-hmm. comes off the brain, right, mm-hmm. into the retina, the back of the eye,
right.
then that diagnosis becomes pretty easy.
It's one way of diagnosing. Now, you can have optic neuritis and not develop MS.
Yeah.
But
so there are other causes of optic neuritis.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, clearly it's important to see your eye doctor about any symptom that may be along those lines. But about 95% of people that have optic neuritis will develop clinically definite MS within 5 years.
Let me remind listeners again, we're talking about multiple sclerosis. My guests today are Mo Hillstrand, an advanced nurse practitioner who does a lot of neurologic subspecialization, of, and particularly with seeing patients with multiple sclerosis. Antonia Fowler is the director of the Alaska Multiple Sclerosis Center here in Anchorage, and Jessica Henning is the program co-coordinator for the National MS Society, the Greater Northwest Chapter. So, Jessica and Antonia, let's bring you in, both of you. Tell us the difference between the organizations. Antonia, if you don't mind, let's start with you and what your organization's doing, the history a little bit.
Okay. The Alaska MS Center was created in 2004, and basically the difference between our two programs, we provide programs for people here in Alaska, whereas the national, what we like to simplify it as, is National MS Society raises money for research. And so what we do is we have programs, educational programs, exercise programs. We're a resource center for materials that have to do with all the medications. We're a site that people can come to discuss what's going on with MS if they have some issues, for people to gather together and just get to know each other and talk about some of their issues. And then, like I said, provide these programs for people.
Mm-hmm. Is your only office here in Anchorage?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
But you serve
but
the state?
But we serve the state. Mm-hmm. Right now we have most of our programs in Matsu Valley, here in Anchorage, and Kenai. And we'd like to do more in Juneau. We do have people in Juneau and throughout the state, but and Fairbanks and stuff. But
is it all right if we mention that you have a close familiarity with multiple sclerosis?
Yes, it is. So I've had MS for 30 years, and like Mo said, you know, you don't get diagnosed right away. Mm-hmm. It was something that was suspected earlier on in 1979, and then I was definitely diagnosed, and you know, 9 years later. So it's something that you live with for quite a long time, not knowing exactly what's going on at that point, especially now with different machines and different capabilities, they can diagnose it a lot quicker.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's still about 10 years average to diagnose.
Wow.
In most people, wow. Even this day and age with the equipment and stuff.
Really?
Have.
Is
yeah.
it that long?
It still
now?
Is.
Because?
Mm. Because the symptoms come and go, wax mm-hmm. and wane, and they seem to be fleeting for many, many people.
No definitive tests?
Well, there are. There are mm-hmm. definitive tests. But commonly, well, there's a couple of ways to identify it, and I don't know exactly how you were diagnosed, but people use what's called McDonald criteria, where they do serial MRIs. So you have to have lesions that change on the MRI or magnetic resonance imaging over space and time. So you have to have a spot at one point in time. Then you got to wait 6 months or 12 months because those things don't change overnight. And then you repeat the studies, and somebody can they must have changes. The other way to diagnose it is with a spinal tap or a lumbar puncture, where you evaluate the actual fluid from the cerebral spinal fluid.
And they'll you're be looking, positive. Looking for evidence of inflammation.
Yeah, there's clear evidence. They'll have positive oligoclonal bands more than in the serum, and they'll have increased IgG synthesis, which shows inflammation in the brain greater than in the blood system. So two ways. Still, the LP is the gold standard.
And just to mention, while to listeners again, if you want to get in touch with either the National MS Society or the Alaska MS Center, you can go to our website, alaskapublic.org. We have links to both organizations directly there. And also, there's a couple of videos plus some other information. So if you want to really begin to understand what's going on at a deeper level, or you have trouble remembering all that we are talking about, heavens, who would know how to do that? But, I mean, you can go back, and it's really two very good videos to help you understand that. Jessica, what's the National Multiple Sclerosis Society all about?
As Anthony had said, on the national level, we do have a Greater Northwest chapter that includes Alaska, Washington State, and then Montana. And we provide the big events for fundraising for mainly research, but we do also do some side programs for patients with MS and families that have members with MS. Everyone knows the Walk MS events and the Bike MS events, probably a little more famously. You see the bikers out along the Seward Highway. That's usually us in the summer. and then Walk MS as well. And so we raise thousands to even millions of dollars for funding of research to further that, you know, that find for a cure. We also do informational resource center, so where patients, usually we get the newly diagnosed patients, and then they're referred to us, so they have a 1-800 number they can call, and then they talk to a person one-on-one and kind of go from there. We also do advocacy, where if someone's having problems trying to find a doctor, someone's having problems with a medication, they don't agree with their doctor, they again can talk to someone one-on-one. We also do financial assistance. Often you'll find that patients are trying to go for the disability. There's a long, drawn-out process, so they do need a little help, a little push, and so the MS Society tries to do that for them. And then they also offer scholarships for people with MS or their children with MS. And that's about it in a nutshell on the national
side. That's a lot.
It is a lot.
It is a lot.
What are the upcoming fundraising things this summer?
Right now, we're focusing on the Walk MS events. So we have one on May 5th in the Mat-Su in Wasilla. And then we have the Anchorage in Juneau on May 12th. And then Copper Valley, Fairbanks, Ketchikan, and Saldana on May 19th. Okay. And so this is a fundraising event and a participation event. So you go around to the certain site and you show your support, and it's a lot of fun.
So does that work where a person can donate money to the biker for however many miles they ride, or how does that work?
It kind of depends on how the teams want to do it. I know with ConocoPhillips, they're they get in a big competition with BP. So they'll just, like, they'll be like, oh, we'll do it in this amount of time. And so that's how they raise their funds for biking. With Walk MS, it's just mostly our teams just ask for donations just to walk the mile around the lake. So pretty light stuff.
Let me remind listeners once again, if you've got comments or questions or want to share your experiences with multiple sclerosis in your family or close friends, please don't hesitate to call. 550-8433 is our local number. 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Mo, what's the natural history of this disorder? Now, when I ask that, I know I'm in trouble because there's already a lot of variability we're talking about. So I don't know if you want to answer this by telling us about the different types that have been organized and how they are recognized and how they work, or just in general, what's the most common natural history of untreated multiple sclerosis? So this is what happens to people before we do anything, or if we don't do anything.
Sure. So we kind of talked about it most commonly shows up between 20 and 40. I mean, I've seen kids as young as 7. I've seen people diagnosed as late as in their 60s, which is unusual, but there's a bounce there too. So over about, if untreated, within about 15 years, a person will need assistance for walking in general. Now, so that's in general. Most commonly, people, about 85% of people will have what they call relapsing remitting MS, which is kind of what we're talking about. So it, they'll have some kind of odd symptoms, and then those will quiet down over a few weeks or months. Then some time later, 6 months, a year, or faster than that sometimes, a person will have another flare of something, and so it waxes and wanes over time. After about 25 years, people can develop secondarily progressive MS, where, you know, every time a person has a flare of MS, there are some brain cells that are damaged or destroyed. And so over a period of time, a person loses their resilience. So we only have so many brain cells we can spare before we start having difficulty walking or thinking or some function. And so when you think about these spots being damaged to the brain that are cumulative over time, there's a point where you're going to lose the ability to do something. So if left untreated, usually people by 15 or 20 years will have some serious deficits. But with treatment these days, like we mentioned earlier, that we didn't have treatment before 1993, and now we do, and the platform medications will cut the disease in half. Some of the other medications that we have are even more dramatic. But back to your discussion or question about the types. There's one kind of MS. MS itself just means multiple scars, so we don't really have a diagnosis more. It's more of a descriptor of what the phenomena is, and it's been around a long time. But there are some people that do develop primary progressive where they're diagnosed and they never have a remission, so they are diagnosed and they deteriorate rapidly. That's not very common, fortunately, and interestingly, I've seen that much more in males than in females. Different people have a different course, which kind of ties that into this. It seems like women do better with the disorder. Men do worse. There are people that we don't see MS in at all, and we briefly talked about that. People, the Alaskan Native population generally does not have MS. I've heard isolated anecdotal reports of people being 100% genetically Alaskan Native and having MS, but I've never seen anybody.
So it's very unusual in certain populations. Mm-hmm. Again, suggesting some genetic
Exactly. Origins. So people have genetics from the Northern European countries. So somebody born and raised in Africa would not be expected to have MS. Now, if that family moved to Northern European and had some Northern European genetics involved, they would be at high risk, and people with African American heritage do get more disabled from this disorder. Another group that seems to have very little MS is Asian population. However, they do have a type of MS that's called Devic syndrome, where they'll have cord lesions and optic neuritis. And you can do a blood test for that. Now, having said that, of course, I have seen a woman that was 100% Chinese, and she clearly had MS. Mm-hmm. So, there's Dr. Lucinetti and a group of researchers. Their theory is that MS is actually four different disease processes based on some of the antibody activity or research that they're doing. They're looking at human leukocyte antigen antibodies and able to classify MS a little bit more carefully. And some of the studies actually show that they can identify who's going to have a more severe course of disease based on that HLA typing. Mm-hmm. So that's new stuff coming down the pike as far as MS.
I don't want to dwell on that. I mean, it gets interesting is that the end result may be the same, even though the mechanisms may be slightly different. For example, with diabetes,
sure.
We now know there's a type 1 and a type 2.
And isn't type 1
pretty much thought of as an autoimmune?
Yeah.
And then there's these issues where you get insulin resistance, which is type 2. I mean, and that's not necessarily autoimmune. So end results may make illnesses appear to be similar when the mechanism of which they happen may be different. I guess that's what I'm hearing you say a little bit as they begin to look at the how MS happens.
Yeah.
Antonia, you mentioned you've had MS for 30 years. And if you don't mind if I also add a little personal side of this thing, since you're here, there's no way I can look at you and say that you've had MS for 30 years. I don't know. I'm not sure I would recognize, but I see nothing unusual about watching you walk in here and talk and so forth. So can you give us a little bit of your story? What was the first thing that happened? And I know diagnosis, it can be difficult, as we've talked about. We may come back and talk about it some more. Do you mind if we talk about it?
No, not at all. What happened was my left side slowly went numb. It was my hand, my arm, then all the way down my leg, you know, and stuff. And I was actually diagnosed, or at that point, my spinal fluid had, you know, thousands of white blood cells in it. So that's why they thought maybe I had MS. That lasted about a week, and I was hospitalized. And at first, orthopedic surgeons thought it was a pinched nerve, you know, in my neck causing the numbness and tingling. That eventually went away, and they told me then at that point that it was a possible MS, that I should watch for numbness, tingling, blah, 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 that the disease process might be happening, but it might not come back. Over the course of those next 10 years, I had a few issues with heat. Heat is a very aggravating thing with MS. And what happens is, with me and with a lot of people with MS, when you get overheated, you totally lose muscle control. And it's like I would take a hot shower and I couldn't even walk back to the bedroom. I mean, I'd slump against the wall. I felt like I had this metal armor over me that would just make me so heavy I couldn't even move. I would slump down to the ground and not be able to move for a while.
And I did not know this. I've been researching this. Heat is a very common thing. So
yeah.
In medical terms, is that pathognomonic? Is that almost certainly diagnostic or very suspicious?
I wouldn't go diagnostic, but it's certainly quite common. Uh-huh. People get overheated. And even like with the cool temperatures up here, people move here because they're more comfortable. But if somebody's out playing baseball or biking and their core temperature heats up, they will feel just like Antonia was talking. Uh-huh. Their symptoms of MS will manifest.
Okay.
Weakness, numbness, tingling, whatever. And just like Antonia said, they get all washed out. So I remind people to, you know, keep cold water around, cool liqueur.
Most of us want to go to Arizona.
I know, but not if you have MS. All my
really?
People
There's
say
somebody who doesn't want
family
to go
reunions in Texas in the summer. No, thank you.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I know. I was always like, why don't I have a disease that I'm supposed to go lay on the beach in Hawaii? You know, that's what you're supposed to do.
People asking me for those prescriptions every day.
You know, they used to diagnose people by putting them in a hot bath, and if their symptoms manifest, and back in the 1900s.
All right. Well, I interrupted your story. So for a long time, and certainly now, 30 years later, the ability to diagnose is probably a little bit better than it was. But I listened to your story.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
But along those lines, too, so what you'll see sometimes, like I can walk around APU Lake in minus 15 temperatures much better, and in 20 degree temperatures much better than I can on a 50 degree day. You know,
so and it's not fatigue, it's a feeling of lack of strength.
It's the way my muscles work,
okay.
because of the electrical activity, I guess, you know, and the conduction, whether they're warm or cold.
Huh.
And I can go much further, so that's something that changes on a day-to-day basis, sometimes on an hourly basis, sometimes on a, you know. So that's one thing with people with MS, you can never predict necessarily how you're going to be in the afternoon when you wake up in the morning or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're planning your day, you have to decide whether, okay, am I going to plan one activity today or four activities today? You learn that you can only do one thing at a time, you know, and be very, very flexible in your day. There's other symptoms, bowel and bladder symptoms, the numbness and tingling, the cognitive problems that, and most things with MS are pretty blind to an outside observer.
Right.
And so there's few people, when your gait gets affected, then you're going to have to use a cane or a walker or something. And I actually, most of the time, when I'm in a warm place, I'll carry a cane, a folding cane that I can use whenever I need to. There's also cooling devices, like the Multiple Sclerosis Society of America. Provides these cooling devices free of charge to anybody with MS who needs it. There are cooling vests that you can wear. There's cooling neck things so that you can be a little more adept at doing whatever you need to do and not be as effective.
Do people who live in a more hot, warmer climate, such as Texas or Arizona, California, move out of those states because of this?
There's a lot of people here from other places, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. And, you know, the people that are in warmer places, you know, I said, aren't you affected by heat? And they say, no. Uh-huh. The people that are affected by heat don't. So I'm Greek.
Well, I would also think that if you grew up and you stay, or if you stayed in a warm climate, you may not know how much wetter you feel. That's another thought that comes to my mind.
Well, and I was just going to say, I will go to Greece in October. I won't go to Greece in the summer.
Huh.
You know, so you choose, as you learn how you're affected, you choose where you're going and stuff like
but
that.
But not just ambient temperature, but if a person becomes ill with a fever of some sort, you know, they can have symptoms too.
And yeah.
Well, we got into this too far. I'm almost, we're past 30 minutes. I need to take a short break. I want to remind the listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our direct line is 550-8433. After this short break, we'll continue to talk with our guest today about multiple sclerosis. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, and you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking with Mo Hillstrand, an advanced nurse practitioner who specializes in neurologic diseases and sees a lot of individuals who have multiple sclerosis. Also with us today is Antonia Fowler, who she is a physical therapist and a director of the Alaska MS Center, where services are supplied for people with multiple sclerosis in the state. And Jessica Henning, is the program co-coordinator with the National MS Society, the Greater Northwest Chapter. And we've learned that the National MS Society is really a fundraising arm and does do some scholarships and other activities that are related to funding multiple sclerosis. If you're listening to the program over the next 20 or 30 minutes, you're welcome to give us a call or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number, 550-8433. We have an outside number, which is toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And I need to take 1 second. I promised that I would promo the Providence Hospital Coaches Clinic for 2012. This is at the Providence Cancer Center Media Room 2285 this April 14th and 15th. This is a 2-day event for coaches, teachers, parents, nurses, adults, and even youths that want to learn more about all aspects of sports medicine. There's orthopedic surgeons, psychologists, nutritionists, physical therapists. If you want more information about the 2-day program, you can call Wallace Wilson at 212-212-6489. Other thing I want to remind everybody again, if you're listening to this program between 7 and 8 on Monday evening on KSKA, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast and won't be able to take your phone calls at that time. We do have one email, Jessica. Let's take this one, and it is a question about the fundraising. It says there's a bicycle fundraiser from Hope to Seward every year. Does it raise money for multiple sclerosis? Are there other bicycle-related local fundraisers?
That is the one bike MS that we do that does fundraising for multiple sclerosis research and funds for state in Alaska to help Alaskans with multiple sclerosis. I do have to mention, though, it's not Hope to Seward anymore. The chapter and the national office felt that to accommodate others that aren't as competitive as, say, the bike teams of ConocoPhillips or people that do the crazy triathlons, that we would make it from Hope to Girdwood, and it'd be a two-day event from now on. So we did that last year with good feedback. We're going to do it again this year. But yeah, that all the funds raised by that go to research, and they also part of it stays in Alaska for financial assistance and scholarships.
Mo, I was wanted to ask a question because Antonia mentioned some cognitive issues when she was talking about her problems, and my little knowledge of multiple sclerosis was that cognitive functions are really not that much affected. I was surprised in some of my research to find that that is the case. Can you tell us a little bit about how the cognitive issues come up in this?
That's a hard question to answer because, as Antonia mentioned, you never know what's going to happen, and that's true for every individual. Some people, I've actually seen people present with cognitive impairment. It just depends on where the lesion lands in the brain. You know, if it lands in an area that where your memory is, then that's what happens. You have problems with memory. So not everybody gets cognitive impairment with MS, though a lot of the research indicates that after about 25 years, yes, there will be some significant cognitive changes. And it's not, it doesn't look like we think about short-term memory problems like an Alzheimer's kind of phenomena where, you know, you can't remember what door you just walked in or what you ate for lunch or something like that. It seems to be more of a sequencing problem. So an example of sequencing would be like making a recipe to cook by. So you put this ingredient in and then that one and so on and so forth. An example is a fellow that, a young guy that I met who presented with cognitive impairment. He would had been able to take a car apart and put it back together in just no time at all. And he was struck with MS, which he looked at the car and he didn't even know what to do with it, you know. So it was a big change for him. He could not sequence tasks. So once we got him on treatment, that all came back. So a lot of it was from the initial insult and then the damage around the area. And once we got him, the inflammation knocked down, then his cognitive capabilities returned pretty much completely. So it's unpredictable. You know, we refer to MS as the great pretender because it can look like just about anything.
When we talk about, and if you read about multiple sclerosis, you clearly see this north-south gradient. The further north you live in the northern hemisphere, the further south in the southern hemisphere, you're more. There seems to be more multiple sclerosis.
Right.
And that correlates nicely with the amount of supposed vitamin D exposure we get, and vitamin D is a hot item now. What's the connection, if any, with vitamin D and multiple sclerosis?
Yeah, that's a good question. And certainly the researchers are looking at that. I don't think we clearly have an answer, but you and I have talked about this a little bit before, about the further away from the equator, the less vitamin D, and we know that it's very important for a number of functions. Rather than being like a vitamin, it's more of a catalyst for a huge variety.
It's actually a hormone nowadays.
absolutely. And so, to the best of my understanding, it affects 23 or 30 different tissues, everything from mood to skin, you know. So
right.
I think one of the most important things about vitamin D and what it does is its ability to reduce inflammation. And that's important for a huge variety of disease processes. We think about all the inflammatory processes that we, even heart disease, you know, stroke, and those things are inflammatory in nature. Right. And so when you look at MS as an autoimmune disorder with inflammation and damage, and then we understand how vitamin D works in there, you see that D is important in, one, downregulating the immune response, and then they think it's probably important with these disruptions in the genome where people will have these major histocompatibility complexes and all this autoimmune jazz. And if D is missing, you these linkages are broken, and so that may be a contributing factor. So D is very, very important, and there's a wonderful pediatric neurologist here in town, Dr. Broderick Smith, and he and I have talked about this extensively, about how important it is. And so I've been getting people to, and their children, because there is genetics in there, to get on D as soon as possible.
Yeah, and it's certainly the presence of adequate and appropriate amounts of vitamin D is a good idea. Low levels are probably not a good idea. What all it means, we're still trying to decide. Yeah. And I got to point out quickly, more is not always better. There are several studies that have suggested after a certain level, things start not being so good, so be careful with how much
and
you
take
as well.
I've seen people come in on all kinds of wild doses of D.
I mean, it's human nature to do that, but this is not a not the thing to do. All right, we have a phone call. Let's go ahead and take that phone call. Carolyn, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, good afternoon. This is Caroline. I wanted to, before I ask my question, I wanted to mention something I heard a number of years ago, and that was that repeated exposure to cold could weaken the immune system. And this was, it wouldn't happen immediately. It would take a cumulative amount of time. And I remember looking out at the young girls in Fairbanks, and this is many years ago, at the less than optimal amount of clothing they had on in order to protect themselves from the cold. And waiting for the bus. At the bus stop for school. Anyway, so, you know, based upon the lack of, that could be something that would be passed down genetically in the colder climes. I mean, that that just struck me as something as possible. My main question
is... Let me comment briefly on this, because this is an issue related to another one close to my heart, and that's the immunizations. And how do I get these two together is that we're often heard that immunizations overwhelm the immune system, and I've just, the first time I've ever heard that cold awakens the immune system. But I always remind people, we got more bacteria in our intestinal tract than we got cells in our body. Our immune system is very active every day, every minute, every day of the year. And a couple of immunizations is not going to change things. And I'm not so sure I buy the cold triggering it either. So anyway, go ahead, Carol.
Well, the only thing about that was the higher levels of it in places and not in Africa, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Anyway,
it does happen in other locales, however.
It gets cold in China too. But anyway, not arguing with you, doctor.
All right, no, I'm just trying to. I don't know the right answer to this. I'm just keeping an open mind. All right.
Okay, absolutely. But the main question I had is, I know you can't recommend doctors, but are there any letters behind the doctor's name that would be more likely to be someone that would be good at screening if you had a suspicion that you had MS? You know, or is it you have to go to the GP first, and how up to date are they on that kind of thing?
Yeah, good question. Let's have Mo answer this question.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, Carolyn. That's a great question. I think it's important to remember that the person and their primary provider is the hub of the wheel, and a neurologist or the specialist are the spokes. So it's important to develop a good relationship with your primary provider, and that person should be able to steer you in the right direction if you would need a neurologist.
So you're saying let's go to the primary provider and tell them the story and encourage them, if necessary, to perhaps refer you on to
because
someone who's doing that.
There's a lot of things that can cause numbness, tingling, weird, all kinds of things. You know, so you want to be in the right place at the right time. So if you go straight to the neurologist, it may not be a neurology problem at all, wasting time.
Okay. All right. I think that makes sense. Also, by the same token, if you still are concerned, it's worth keeping an open discussion with that primary care provider. Don't just fire them and something, you know, talk to them again. Physicians want to do the right thing, and we're not all on the same page with every little disease. But if you really have some concerns, I think it's important to get those things resolved in your mind as best we can. Antonia, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, too, once you're diagnosed with MS, don't think everything that happens to you is a result of MS.
Oh, absolutely.
Too, that you always have to have that connection with your general practitioner, because something may be going on that has nothing to do with MS and you need help with it. So keep those lines open.
Well, let's just talk in generalities about treatment then. We need to get there before we run out of time. And there was an email sent to us, and I shared it with you, sharing a YouTube video about another potential treatment that is going to let me lead into this, and I want to address that person's concerns or questions. But what do we know about treatment?
Well, we know that starting treatment early, as soon as you're diagnosed, is important. The platform medications that we have can cut the disease in half. We've got about 45-50% reduction in future disability. We have medications on the market now that can, if a person has more aggressive MS, we can use these bigger guns, if you will. I think some of the medications are going to be, more commonly we'll be starting to use these monoclonal antibodies for treatment that are more powerful to reduce the disorder.
So basically we're fighting the immune response with immune response.
That's right.
And we're trying to block this stuff from happening.
Right. And then don't forget the symptomatic treatment too. Mm-hmm. You know, like Antonia mentioned, people can have problems with bowel and bladder and that sort of thing. People can have problems with walking. And so, yes, it's very, very important to get treatment, stay on treatment, keep that MS knocked down to the best of your ability, and then you can stay healthy. Because people with MS are not generally sick. They have phenomena that occur periodically, but in general, they're working and driving cars and biking and doing all this jazz. I mean, they're living their lives. Mm-hmm. So as long as the inflammation, the disorder is knocked down, I mean, a person can live a happy, healthy life and have kids and do all that stuff. But there are treatments for some of the symptoms, too. And for example, spasticity is a common thing that people have where the muscles will kind of be fighting each other. It makes it hard to walk around. And so there's treatments, muscle relaxers and so on, that are not narcotic that can be used. And there's a medicine on the market now which is a remake of rifampin, you know, that used to be an old TB drug. Mm-hmm. And it's a potassium channel blocker, and so it allows people to walk more easily. So this medication enhances the electrical conduction across the nerve fiber, even if it's been demyelinated. Mm-hmm. So that has been on the, you know, out in for public use over about a year now, and I've seen wonderful things with that medication. It's not for treatment of MS; it's symptomatic, and it improves conduction across the neuron. I've seen people have improvement in vision, improvement in walking, improvement in thinking. If you anything that involves electrical conduction across a fiber. So there was some discussion about, well, gee, would that wear out, you know, these potassium channels? Would people just make more channels or whatever? But so far, I've seen people using it for up to 10 years with good effect. And so their coordination of movement and movement in general is much easier. And when you move around more easily, you have less fatigue, too.
Before we go on to this video that we reviewed suggesting a different approach, what about risks inside or side effects? I think it's something I try to talk about as often as I can on this program is anytime we do any treatment, it doesn't matter if someone tells you to stand on your head, you got to think about what's the risk of doing it, what's the risk of not doing it.
Right.
And so here we've got a very prolonged, variable course. Mm-hmm. It seems like it really takes some knowledge and discussion and good interaction with patients to decide when you do certain treatments, when you don't, because there are going to be risks of any treatment.
That's exactly right, yeah. There are risks. So, you know, you have to sit down and figure out what am I about to lose here? And and I think it's important to talk to your provider, neurology person, or about the risks and benefits. Not everybody has every side effect that's listed on the package, of course, but it's important to be aware that there are those, and those vary with the medication. I don't know how much detail you.
I think that's enough at this point. If we have specific questions, if anybody wants to call and ask about a medication they're on and side effects, we'll be glad to.
Yeah, because it's pretty specific to each drug. Yeah, but back to the YouTube thing. I think that was very interesting. Somebody sent that in, and we both reviewed that, and it was about diet. So there, probably 20, 30 years ago, there was a Dr. Swank. I think he was in Arizona, and he put together the Swank diet. It was high in protein. It was kind of difficult to follow, but it was touted as a treatment for MS, and there are people that do stay on this diet and seem to have some improvement in symptoms. This particular YouTube that we watched, this individual with MS supported eating, I think it was 3 dinner plates of green leafy vegetables a day and fruits and vegetables. And I strongly support that. I think that people do need to eat a balanced diet and they'll feel better in general. So I don't think I've seen MS cured with diet, but I think in general, good all-around health is important, regardless of the disorder.
I would agree, and I would just make a comment. It's my recollection. This was a physician, and the other thing that disturbed that was claiming this, and the other disturbing thing was this was on a TED talk. TED is a group of individuals or specialists that have gotten some notoriety, and so it's easy to see these. I'm not sure what the TEDx talks are and so forth, but I usually look at these as more reliable kinds of bits of information. So it was disturbing to me to see this really a personal observation of a person who was in a wheelchair, ate a good diet, no longer had any symptoms. And there are no well-done control studies with an accurate diagnosis that shows that diet alone is going to do this. And so I don't think bad diet is a bad idea. I don't think it's going to hurt anything. But it's very unlikely any physician, any person in the United States is going to stumble on to a dramatic cure on a disorder like this by themselves. And so, you know, extraordinary claims of success need extraordinary proof, and this is not extraordinary proof.
Yeah, you know, they say
you got to be careful here.
If it's too good to be true, it probably is.
Probably is. Yeah. So I mean, in unfortunately, progressive, uncurable disorders, it's human nature to want to seek and find that kind of bits of information. Antonia, comments about this. You and Jessica run into situations like this as well, people finding new things that they want to ask you about?
Oh, yeah. And, we were sent that video, too.
Oh, you were? Okay.
I was individually. Okay. I tried eating. I can't eat more than a few leaves of kale, one thing. But yeah, people will try anything because they're desperate to be cured, you know. And so you need to be very careful about what you're seeing on the internet and what you're being told.
Yeah.
And be wise.
And again, any treatment has some risk. You say, well, what's the risk of eating kale or something else? Well, it's what you're not eating. It's what you're not doing. It's what you're not pursuing. There's lots of downsides to these. And I also thought just a minute ago, it wouldn't make sense that Native Americans and Eskimos and so forth would not have any multiple sclerosis. They certainly do not eat this diet. You would think they'd have an increased risk of
There's an interesting article written by Dr. Michael Hollick on vitamin D. It's called Vitamin D in the 21st Century Osteoporosis and Beyond. He describes that, where he talks about the Laplanders and the Alaska Natives, and they eat items that have a lot of vitamin D in them. So they don't get it from the sun, but the diets that they eat have that D in them.
What about long-term disabilities? We've focused on a picture of relapsing, coming and going. I have a patient sitting in front of me who's 30 years. I can't tell, has this disorder. Long-term, there are some disabilities that have begun to have some effects. Where do patients go for help with those kinds of things?
Most of them, I think most people are at home, thank God, these days with their spouses. Some people actually end up places like Providence Extended Care because they need more help and they're in power chairs and don't have anyone to help them at home. Mo, other places here in town?
Social Security Disability, there's a lot of agencies that help people get insurance, get housing and so on. So if a person has a disability, they apply for disability. I don't know the exact process, but there are a number of people that get covered, and they can get Medicare coverage at an early age if they have a disability.
Costs of this disorder, these newer medications, these anti-inflammatory treatments for affecting the immune system are extremely expensive. What are the options for people who need help financially? Is that something that the National Multiple Sclerosis Society is involved in?
Absolutely. We do provide some medication financial assistance. That's usually where a lot of the financial assistance goes to, because a lot of these medications are upwards of $2,000, $3,000 a month if you don't have insurance. Remember when my dad first started in Avonex was $2,500 a month. And needless to say, he couldn't stay on it very long. And so we try and do what we can, and then there's local pharmaceutical companies that also do it. And then again, if you're going down the road of disability, then applying for disability, once you get it, it seems to really help that financial burden.
Okay. The drug companies themselves will help patients, and the drugs are much more expensive than that now. And some of them are, you know, $10,000 a month.
Right. But
the medication companies themselves will help patients a lot. They'll provide medication for them up to a certain amount of time, and you don't have to be in the poorhouse to apply for those.
We've only got a couple of minutes. We're in our last couple of minutes. Antonia and Jessica, I want to start with you all just to give us a what you want people to remember from this. And if we have time, I'm going to go to Mo, since Mo had most of the opportunity here earlier. What do you want us to remember about Alaska MS Center?
Basically, I want people to know just about our program that we provide, you know, exercise programs. We've got a three-day-a-week pool program with the YMCA. We've got yoga classes, and we've got a disability fact and fun fair coming up in April. And we do fundraising also. Mother's Day weekend, we have a flower campaign to provide money for our local programs here. And I'm also teaching a Balance Core and More class to help people get out. We do common adventures in the summer. And then I do want to make one plug for the specialty tier drugs. That's what we're on. They're called specialty tier drugs. And so in the legislature right now, there's some bills going on. So people be in touch with that and make your comments known about what you want done with the specialty tier drugs.
Okay. Jessica?
The National MS Society is here to provide financial assistance. We are a major fundraising group for research and to find a cure, but there's other things that we do on a more local basis, financial assistance, scholarships for students who need to go to college. We help with that. We don't want to see MS stop you in the tracks. We always have this little logo of movement or move it. That's part of it, and that we have a major fundraising event coming up right now, which is Walk MS. The one in Anchorage is on May 12th. And we're hoping for a really good turnout. So far, so good. And those happen every year all over Alaska. So,
all right. Mo, you got 30 seconds to tell us everything you want us to remember.
Oh, I don't know. Thank you very much. This is always interesting. And I find MS fascinating. And people are just moving on and living their lives. And, life can be full and fun and full of adventure, even if you have MS.
Okay. Thanks very much to all of you for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
My thanks to our guests again today, Mo Hillstrand, Antonia Fowler, and Jessica Henning. If you'd like to continue with today's conversation at all, you can join us at KSKA on your Facebook, and you can find the links at our website at alaskapublic.org. Remember, there's lots of video information and good links if you want to learn more about multiple sclerosis. However, why don't you join us next Monday afternoon, April 16th at 2 p.m. as well. We're going to be discussing, is it really a right of humans to end their life if they so choose? Our discussant will be Dr. Larry Egbert. He's a retired anesthesiologist and founder and former medical director of Final Exit Network. So why don't you tune into your health and learn more Monday, April 16th from 2 to 3 p.m., repeating the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1 KSKA. Pat Yack is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and helped us today with the audio engineering. Thanks for listening, especially to those who took the time to call and email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.